You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, according to federal data, Wisconsin has the sixth highest high school graduation rate in the nation, but has the largest gap in graduation rates between black and white students. We'll talk to an education reporter and get the details.
First, a power struggle between liberal and conservative values as part of everyday life this election season. For many people, it feels like the most polarized we've ever been.
In fact, it's nothing new. In 1950s Milwaukee can be a case study in seeing the gains of one side being opposed by the other, and the echoes are still being heard today.
Tula Connell describes the tension in Wisconsin's largest city in her new book, Conservative Counter-Revolution, Challenging Liberalism in 1950s Milwaukee. She joins us now from our Milwaukee studios. Tula, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So set the scene for us. It's Milwaukee, 1950s. What was life like in the city and how was it being governed?
Milwaukee in the 1950s has a reputation of being very progressive and very socially expansive. And the mayor in 1948 was Frank Seidler, a socialist. He was a self-identified socialist, and he served until 1960 and throughout the 50s. And Milwaukee was heavily unionized. One third of the population was in a union. And so if you look back and you think about Milwaukee, as a lot of people may do, they envision a very progressive environment. But in fact, Zeidler, throughout his three terms in office, was challenged by conservatives on housing and on everything from big issues to little ones, like whether the city should have a public television station.
And so you said there was this undercurrent, in this strong socialist, what seemed like very liberal city, there was this undercurrent of conservatism rising up and looking toward the future. Can you talk a little more about that?
Well, following World War II, historians call the New Deal era was very much a part of the entire national environment, and that involved the policies and the practices enacted under Roosevelt, such as Social Security and expanded rights for workers under unions. And in 1949, the Federal Housing Act passed, giving cities and states federal money to create affordable housing. So all of these policies were very socially progressive, and that was the environment of the nation and Milwaukee. And some people, some conservatives, wanted to change that. They wanted to take that back. And in my book, one of the conservatives whom I highlight, who's on the far right, was William Grady, an industrialist. And he explicitly said that the conservatives like him need a 50-year project to take the country back to where it was before the New Deal.
And this 50-year project was quite visionary at the time, because that's a long time to look to the future. I want to ask you, how did conservative media also get started during this time, and what was the Facts Forum?
In the 1950s, there was a lot more labor press, foreign language press, but slowly that began to go away. And what replaced it were a lot of alternative conservative publications, such as the Facts Forum. That was started by Hunt in Texas, but it was a national publication, and it reached people in Milwaukee and around the nation. And it was sort of a precursor to what I would think of as an internet mobilizing tool. In the publication, which came out every month, Hunt encouraged people to write their congresspeople, to write letters to the editor. He paid them if their letter to the editor got published. He encouraged them to set up local communities and where they could talk about the issues. And so it provided a network for people who felt alienated by the New Deal policies and who felt alone in their conservatism. And in providing a network, of course, you get strength. And so that and other forums, there was the Mannion Forum, which is a very conservative radio show. Those started in the 1950s. And in fact, William Grady was a precursor of conservative media. He bought several suburban weeklies around Milwaukee, including Wauwatosa paper at that time, and so was able to supplant the historically strong labor voices and foreign language press.
We're talking with Tula Connell. She's a labor writer and historian, lives in Washington, D.C., and is the author of Conservative Counter-Revolution, Challenging Liberalism in 1950s Milwaukee. And Tula, during this era, you found that the far-right conservatives were able to bring young people into their fold. How did that influence their long-term 50-year strategy for furthering that conservative agenda?
That was a key part of their strategy, and it started out slowly. It wasn't as expansive as it has become. But, for instance, William Grady supported a freedom school in Colorado started by a conservative, Robert Lefebvre, and the school was very far-right, very libertarian. And Grady funded scholarships for students from Marquette and the University of Wisconsin to go to the school and take two-week courses in economics, very conservative economics. And it was funded by people like the Millikens in North Carolina, the textile magnates, and it drew high-level economists such as Austrian economists who were very conservative from the Chicago School, and it was not a small operation, but it was just the beginning of educating young people, and they saw that as crucial to changing the mindset of the public, which actually supported government by a large margin, supported unions by a large margin, and they wanted to turn all of that back to supporting business.
So fast forward now to today's election and Donald Trump's mantra of Make America Great Again. Are you seeing his messaging and things, ideas he embraces that trace back to these 1950s conservatives?
Well, Donald Trump doesn't represent a direct embodiment of the lineage of the Republicans from the 1950s. Ted Cruz would be more in line with that. I think Donald Trump's is sort of spinning in his own parallel universe. I do think he's drawing from a lot of disaffected working class people who don't see their issues, especially jobs and economic issues, being taken seriously in the Democratic Party. And Trump is another phenomenon. But the lineage of the far right, like Grady's followers, would end in a Ted Cruz rather than a Donald Trump.
So where does the counter-revolution go from here? Do we wait until Election Day to know what happens next? Or are you seeing a new path forward for conservatives that is informed by what went on in the 50s?
It's hard to say as a historian to predict the future. I prefer to
stay
talk
in the
about
past.
The past, right? I think I was speaking last night and someone asked me if Grady's dreams and vision had come true, and I think it's come true far beyond what he would have imagined possible in the 1950s. In the 1950s, conservatives, especially far, far right conservatives like a Grady, were not taken seriously by the large majority of the nation or the city, and to have their issues pretty much take over Congress, I mean, many of the far right are in Congress right now, is something I don't think Grady and his business friends would have imagined.
Tula, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you again very much. It's been a pleasure.
That was Tula Connell, a labor writer and historian who lives in Washington, D.C. Her new book is Conservative Counter-Revolution, Challenging Liberalism in 1950s Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Halloween is just a couple weeks away. We'll talk to a film critic about the scariest movies of all time.
But first,
we recently learned that America's high school graduation rate went up to 83%, which is the highest on record. That's good news. More African-American and Latino students are graduating than ever before.
That was President Obama announcing new federal data on high school graduation rates in the U.S. Wisconsin comes in sixth in the nation with an overall graduation rate of 88.4%. But the state is number one in the widest graduation rate gap between white and black students.
Erin Richards joins us with the details. She's the education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Erin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, it sounds like good news at first, a good, solid overall graduation rate, sixth in the nation. But then there's this racial graduation gap. How big a gap are we talking about?
It's wide, and it's concerning, and it's not the first time this has happened. Wisconsin ranks the lowest or among the lowest of states in the country on a variety of measures that look at the gap between where white, mostly middle-class students score and where black students score, most of whom are low-income. But this is pretty stark. I mean, this was a big news item yesterday with the president touting the increase overall in the U.S. graduation rate. But when you take the numbers and you tease out where white students are in Wisconsin compared to black students, you end up with the number one widest gap in the country.
And do we know why the gap is so big here in the state?
You know, there's a lot of different reasons. I mean, we clearly have a large concentration of poverty in the state's largest school district in Milwaukee. Historically, there have been a lot of conditions that have made it very hard for black children and black adults to get ahead in this city. There's a combination of forces that happen among everything from home life and home support to, reforms in the schools themselves. I was talking to a school board member yesterday about the conditions in Milwaukee, and there's a lot of attention on, the absence of fathers and role models for young black men. When you look at the graduation rate for black students in Milwaukee, it's 10 percentage points lower for black males than it is for black females. So you certainly see, gaps within the gaps as well.
We've had alarms sounded on racial achievement gaps in schools a lot over the last couple of years. Do we see a change over time in this graduation gap? Are we getting a little better, or do we know that?
Well, the problem, at least for Milwaukee, when I was spending some time yesterday with the test scores, was that, the district's black student graduation rate has been trending downward for the past 5 years, and I was really trying to understand why that was happening. The new superintendent, newer superintendent, I should say, Darian Driver, is very focused on this issue, but I wasn't able to get a good explanation for why, given a variety of other factors, including looking at things like the five-year graduation rate, which is still down a little bit in MPS over the more recent years. And there just isn't a good reason why yet. When I talked to the state superintendent yesterday, Tony Evers, he said, I think that it's in part because there aren't that many students in Milwaukee that are participating in rigorous summer programming. So that's cutting off 3 months of the year where in a lot of other cities, even like Green Bay, there's twice as many public school children that participate in summer programming than there are in Milwaukee, and Green Bay is a much smaller city. So Tony Evers is advocating asking the state legislature to give Milwaukee more flexibility to start school earlier in the earlier than they do now, which is always after Labor Day because of a state law. He thinks that could try to get some more resources, more academic programming to students for a greater share of the year itself.
Now, school choice programs, Milwaukee in particular, was an early adopter of different types of voucher programs, charter schools. Do we have any sense of how the racial achievement gaps are doing in those schools?
Well, it would be helpful if we could get graduation rates for the private voucher schools in Milwaukee. That's something that lawmakers have not mandated, and it's something that, as the public and as a journalist, we can't get access to. Those are private high schools, and they're not required to, report their graduation rates. So we don't really know what's happening there. We don't know exactly how many students are shifting from private voucher schools into Milwaukee public schools at the high school level either, because that data, we can't get it from the private institutions. There's fewer charter high schools, in part because, high schools are expensive to run. So most independent charter school operators that want to operate a public school are usually focusing on the younger grades, because the per pupil amount is more sufficient for younger student programming.
Talking to Aaron Richards, education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. New national numbers out on high school graduation rates. Good news overall, graduation rates nationwide going up. Minority graduation rates going up. Wisconsin, sixth best in graduation rates overall, but the biggest gap in the nation between white and black students on graduation rates has a lot of people all over the state trying to figure out why that is. Aaron, we focused on Milwaukee a lot. I know Dane County has had very high disparities, racial disparities, any way you want to slice it, economic, educational, things like that. What do we know about this disparity outside of Milwaukee?
You know, I was doing some looking at the numbers the other day. You know, Madison has gotten better. 5 years ago, I think they were still around 50% graduation rate for black students. That has gone up, I think, if I remember correctly, and you're testing me because I didn't memorize all these.
And I'm sorry, neither did I.
I think it's up to around maybe 57% now. Their white student graduation rate in Madison is quite high, so you're still going to see that kind of gap there. And, that's another point to sort of stress, is that part of the reason for the achievement gap in Wisconsin, and there's one in other states where white students perform quite well, is that in part it's wide because white students score so high, and then when you have children of racial minorities scoring so low, you widen, you know, this gap looks even bigger than it does in other states. The graduation rate has gone up a little bit for black students in some of our other large urban districts, but it's still not where it needs to be to make sure that, you know, we're sort of closing that gap over time. And this has been a focus in the state for a number of years now.
Are people around the state, when you talk to policymakers, are they saying if only we could do what they're doing in, I don't, any other state or urban area that seems to be successful? Are people trying to transplant successful solutions from elsewhere?
You know, I wish there was more outrage. I think that it can, you know, reporting on this subject is sometimes difficult because there's a lot of numbers and it can get very technical very quickly. But what we're really talking about is kids' lives here, and like what kind of diploma these kids are going to get, what kind of credential is going to allow them to be able to pursue meaningful work in their lives. And yesterday when I was looking at these scores, I had a hard time coming up with who, you know, would give me an emotional response about this being a big deal. So, I mean, I'm not alone. A lot of other people care very deeply about this. But sometimes when you think, man, this is a big deal, we need to be talking about this, there just isn't the amount of outrage that you would really expect from, local politicians, state politicians.
Is part of the problem that there's a partisan response on an education issue like this? One side of the aisle knows that the solution is school choice and charter schools. The other side is more money for the schools, other solutions. Is that part of the problem, that this quickly becomes a political issue?
No, absolutely. I mean, there's been finger pointing here for decades. But, of course, you know, the public schools in Milwaukee, I mean, they'll say, well, you know, our resources have been diverted. We're funding, you know, two significantly large sectors here. And that means a diversion of resources. The people on the independent charter and the voucher school side will say, look, you know, kids deserve good options. The whole reason why our sector rose in the first place is because for many years, there weren't great options for a lot of low-income people living in the middle of Milwaukee. So there certainly is a lot of sort of, you know, a bunker down mentality. You know, you're seeing some more partnerships happen, I think, especially under MPS Superintendent Darian Driver. But to really move the needle on this, we're going to have to see more cooperation between some of these sectors, which is what people have been talking about for years. But it's when it comes down to action and actually having to work with people who you've sort of, you know, vowed to never cooperate with, that's, you know, where we see the real inertia.
So we're going to call her. Chris is with us in Elkhorn. Chris, hi.
Hey, you know, I think we should go to less agrarian calendar and more of a balanced calendar, sometimes called year-round education. I did a study when I was in college. Texas did this, and they narrowed their achievement gap by 18 points when they went to a balanced calendar.
Chris, thanks for that call. And you mentioned earlier, Aaron, the idea of maybe not that full year-round schooling, but starting school earlier to get rid of some of that summer learning loss. Is this something that people are talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad that caller brought that up, because there are a number of schools in Milwaukee that do have year-round programming on that balanced calendar. It's generally quite popular with parents. A lot of students, you know, seem to appreciate the support system that's in place for most of the year. I haven't done a direct crunch of scores to compare, you know, achievement or graduation rates at those schools versus the public ones. But it certainly has the support of a lot of parents. And there was a movement in Milwaukee not too long ago to try to, you know, get everybody on the same calendar. And there was a significant amount of pushback from the balanced calendar schools. And Darian Driver relented, and those schools stayed on that calendar. Could we see more high schools move that direction? I don't know. That would be, that would be a big shift. But I think it's worth talking about.
And briefly, Aaron, you talked to one official who said, hey, let's look at ACT scores. Maybe some kids are graduating from some schools, not getting those high scores, though not prepared. ACT schools might be a better measure. Briefly, that versus graduation rates as a measure of success.
Right. So what you're addressing is the fact that you can have a high graduation rate if you have pretty easy standards in high school, and if you have pretty easy credit recovery programs for kids who are far behind to kind of zip through, to kind of earn a credential and move along. But we want that high school diploma to actually mean something. We want it to show that you've actually understood the content and have a basic understanding of core subjects to move forward in life. And so what the ACT can do, and we just got those new scores out today, so it'll take probably another day to dig into them deeply, but the ACT shows you how students are performing in science, in math, in writing, in English at the high school level at their junior year.
And we'll leave it there. That's Aaron Richards from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel looking at graduation rates here in Wisconsin. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're listening to the theme from Halloween, one of the most iconic horror movies of all time.
We're only a couple weeks out from actual Halloween. Some might say this is the best time of year to watch a scary movie. We want to hear from you. What is your favorite scary movie? What do you think makes a good horror film? What would you recommend to someone looking for a spooky movie to watch to help get into the Halloween spirit? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post your favorites on the Central Time Facebook page.
Reggie Ponder joins us now to talk about scary movies. He's known as Reggie the Real Critic, Real, R-E-E-L, by the way. He appears weekly on Vocalo in Chicago and critiques movies for several other media outlets. Reggie, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, I'm glad to be back. How you guys doing?
Very well, thank you. So let's start out with, what are the essential ingredients for a classic scary movie, one that will stay with us for generations? What do you put in it?
So the essentials for a classic scary movie, I think, actually change. And I think they change over time. And I actually think that they're personal. I asked you guys, and hopefully you'll talk about it a little later, about what your favorite scary movie is, and your reasons will probably be different. So there's certain things. One of them is fear of death. So you're thinking, oh, man, is somebody going to die? Oh, no, not that person. That's one of those things. And you're like, please, not that person. And sometimes you're talking at the screen saying things like, look out, look behind you. No. Oh, I guess he's gone. But another one for me is Disfigurement. So one of the movies for me that's really scary it was The Fly. And it might not be thought of as a horror film, but I was just scary just from the way in which he transformed into this fly. It just creeped me out, and I think I jumped in the seat of the person who was sitting next to me. I didn't know them exactly. So there are a number of things, and again, I think they're different. Suspense is a big one. Is the suspense real? Do you believe it? Because sometimes you'll go to a scary movie and you'll see people actually laugh because the suspense is just doesn't ring true. I don't know if that has happened to you guys where you go to a scary movie and people are like, yeah, right, that's not even funny.
Well, let's talk about suspense, and let's talk about one that I picked as one of my favorite scary movies of all time, and I saw it maybe at the right age to have it stick with me. This is Alien. Going to give a listen to the captain of the cargo ship Nostromo explaining to the crew why their ship, they refer to it as Mother, woke them up halfway home instead of just outside Earth's orbit where they expected to wake up.
Some of you may have figured out we're not home yet. We're only halfway there.
What?
Mother's interrupted the course of our journey.
What?
Yeah. She's programmed to do that should certain conditions arise. They have.
Like what?
Seems she has intercepted a transmission of unknown origin. She got us up to check it out.
A transmission? Out here?
Yeah.
What kind of a transmission?
Acoustical beacon. It repeats at intervals of 12 seconds.
SOS?
I don't know.
Human?
Unknown.
So things go downhill from there, spoiler alert, and lots of suspense. It's a science fiction movie, sure, but I always say that this is a horror movie. Reggie, talk about science fiction, horror, and suspense there in Alien.
Well, a couple of things as it relates to Alien. That made my list too, Rob. It's one of those that I don't really like scary movies as a – if you invited me, I'd probably say, no, I don't want to go. Because I'm always scared. But Aliens, they just did a really good job. And I think what they do on Alien is that they borrow a number of things from what horror films do. And when you talk about suspense was fantastic. But it was also very scary. So they'll make it darker. Horror movies like to make things in the dark and make it darker. So the environment seemed scary in that regard. And another thing is that it was the fear of the unusual with Alien, is that you don't know what it is, you're scared of the unusual, and that's one of those things that sci-fi movies borrow heavily from these spooky and scary movies.
Reggie, I want to go back to the 1960s to revisit Night of the Living Dead. And here's this clip where Johnny is teasing his sister Barbara in a graveyard. And little did he know, he was also foreshadowing what was about to happen.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're acting like a child.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
So what made Night of the Living Dead so scary, and what was up with these ghouls?
Well, you picked up on a couple of things. The fear of death is one that I already spoke about. Being in the dark in a cemetery, come on. Now, I know some kids actually now during Halloween, they go to a cemetery, but that's probably the last place that you want to be. So it is a scary place. And I think they did a good job also with the suspense piece, because while it might have foreshadowed what was going to happen, you still were like, is it really going to happen? It's an art to do that. To say, okay, we're going to kind of tell you what might happen, but maybe it might not happen, and then it does happen, and you're scared. So I think they did a good job with that.
We're talking about scary movies with Reggie Ponder. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. Is there a horror movie you love? horror movie you love to fear, call in 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers. Thomas is on the line in Milwaukee. Thomas, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What scary movie do you have for us?
Yeah, so I've seen a lot of scary movies, but there's one I just saw recently called Arachnophobia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Starring Jeff Daniels. And, that movie, I thought it was going to be just I don't know what I was expecting. But anyway, it was really scary. It was hard to watch. Because it's just a simple thing like spiders, but they just took it to extremes.
And Thomas, I got to ask, how are you with spiders in real life? And you can have a different answer for before and after watching Arachnophobia.
Oh, my God. Before, it was I was kind of scared of spiders, and they didn't freak me out that much. But after the movie, it's I can't go anywhere without being scared of a spider being there, especially a barn.
Oh, no. Thomas, thank you so much. And I will put in a plug for spiders. We talked to a Wisconsin spider expert who says they mostly don't bite. They mostly do a lot of good. But that idea of taking something, a lot of Hitchcock movies and Stephen King books, take that familiar thing that maybe you're a little creeped out by and take it to an extreme. The birds, I guess I'm thinking about.
Absolutely, the birds. So when you look at it, snakes, spiders, rats, and other kind of crawly things are really scary. And what happens is that, at least what happens to me, is that I'm sitting in the movie and I'm feeling now that something is crawling over me. I'm like, don't touch me. No, that type of thing. So creepy, crawly things, that's one of the things that they use to really get you scared. And it actually plays on some real fears, too, because people are really scared of snakes, spiders, rats, those types of things. So I think that it works really well when you put it either in a horror movie or a sci-fi movie.
And, Reggie, one of my favorite picks for Scariest Movie is one that I bought into the hoax completely, the Blair Witch Project, the 1999.
Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, the Blair Witch Project, the 1999 version. And here's the iconic close-up shot from the Blair Witch Project.
And this is where we've ended up. And it's all because of me that we're here now. Hungry and cold. And hunted.
So, what about this element of, reality, of truth entering into scary movies?
Yeah, that's one that actually resonates really well. When you look at a movie like The Blair Witch Project that has some real truth in it, you don't have to suspend belief. You're saying to yourself, I could actually be in this situation. And that makes it even scarier. And so there's some movies, for instance, that rely on witches, Ouija boards, the some of the supernatural things like seances and things of that nature. And since those are things that actually happen today, that people actually indulge in those things, that actually makes it that more real and that much more scarier.
Back to our callers now with Gayla in Black Earth. Hi.
Hi there. I was just listening to you on the radio, and I had to call and tell you that when I was about 15, 16, I went to go see Night of the Living Dead at an outdoor movie theater in Montevideo, Minnesota, with five girls, and it was so scary, and I was driving, and I remember looking in the rearview mirror, seeing something coming at me, and it was my face. And I just screamed. I still get razor creeps, and to this day, I cannot look in my rearview mirror without thinking of Night of the Living Dead, because I thought that face was right at me, on me, coming in from the back of the car.
Yeah. Oh, Gayla, I think the key words there, Reggie, were when I was 15 or 16, because I'm thinking, that's when I saw Alien, that's when I saw Nightmare on Elm Street, a couple Twilight Zone episodes, including one looking in a rearview mirror that I still think about when I look in my rearview mirror. Is there something about those mid-teen years that makes the horror movie really stick with us?
Oh. Absolutely, and those are the fun times when you're a teenager and you actually go to these movies, because you probably haven't seen enough of them in the first place. You've probably been sheltered by your parents at 10, 11, 12. They wouldn't allow you to see these movies. So now you have carte blanche. You get to run out and see them, and it scares the bejesus out of you. I won't curse. I won't use any swearing because I know you just had that segment. So it scares the bejesus out of you. I do want to mention before we get off, because I know we don't have that much time, is that at least ask Kate, is that, Kate, where did you see the Blair Witch Project?
Good question.
Yes. And so it's very vivid to me. It was this cold, dank uptown theater in Minneapolis, and it was winter and dark, and that all influenced this whole
nice.
Aura of the Blair Witch Project.
And I really wanted to ask you that question because I think, Rob, to your question, not only does the age play into it, but actually, where did you go see it?
Hmm.
Who did you go see it with? What time of year was it? All that kind of stuff kind of plays into it. And I think that's why right now, next week, in fact, this week and next week, three scary movies are coming out. And because they know it's the Halloween period, it's the Halloween time, and that's the time when you're ready for a good scare or scared for a good scare.
We're talking to Reggie Ponder now about scary movies leading up to Halloween.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a movie you watch every Halloween to get ready? Is there a scary movie that scared you so much you will never watch it ever again? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're picking up our discussion now about horror movies with Reggie Ponder, known as Reggie the Real Critic.
Call in with your favorite scary movie at 800-642-1234. Let us know what makes a good one, a bad one. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Right back to our callers. Sean is on the line in Appleton. Sean, hi.
Hi. The movies that I really enjoy watching are the older ones, like The Exorcist, The Omen, Poltergeist. That's one of my favorites. Even back to Rosemary's Baby. I like the old classic movies, not remade, the old ones.
And it sounds like you like the supernatural kind of stuff, some of it religious themed. Does that appeal to you in particular, Sean?
Yeah, actually, no. When you mentioned it, yeah.
Omen, Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby, yeah.
Yep, exactly.
Well, thanks so much, Sean. Reggie, any shout-outs to those classics?
Yeah. So when you look at some of the list, and there are a lot of lists out there. There's an American Film Institute list. There's a Time Out London 100 list, and that was done by 100 experts in the field. And those films all do movies like Psycho, Jaws, The Exorcist, The Shining, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Psycho, Rosemary Baby, and Halloween. So those all kind of come in either the top 10 or the top 20. A couple of mine don't make it to the top 10 or top 20, but as I said, The Fly is one of the ones for me, as well as Nightmare on Elm Street.
Oh, yeah.
And Reggie, we understand that you have a very low tolerance level for scary movies.
I do.
It's okay. You can admit it. Yes. So, you know, why are some people able to tolerate them, actually love them, embrace them, and others can't even stomach them?
I think it's the same reason that people go to these haunted houses and just have a great time. They don't mind a good scare. You kind of know you're going to be scared, so you're in anticipation of that. But I think that sometimes our fears to get the best of us for people who don't love these movies. So I am scared of spiders. My sister Alvina is posting on Facebook right now. She's not scared of spiders. Spiders are not scary. But I'm scared of spiders. So you put that on TV, on the movie screen, maybe I don't want to go see that. So I think sometimes our fears actually prevent us from enjoying and having fun in that way.
Back to our callers. Terry is with us next in Mineral Point. Terry, hi.
Mary. Hi.
What did you want to share with us, Terry?
Oh, yeah. The classic. Julie Harris, I believe it was The Haunting. The movie, I think it was 1965. Black and white, made from the book The Haunting of Hill House. Do you know that one?
I think so. Was this a kind of a more subtle one? Like it didn't hit you over the head with the scary stuff? It kind of was creepy and built up. Is that right?
Very much so. so. Very much so. You never saw anything.
Right.
You know, you heard things, but you never saw anything, and you were never really sure if anything was going to be there or not. If you, the door would bend inward, some banging going on outside the door, and pressing the door inward, and the door looks like it's going to collapse, but you have the feeling if you open the door, there'd be nothing there.
Wow. Terry, thank you so much. And that brings up a point I wanted to get to, Reggie, that I'm always amazed by horror movies that, you know, they don't hit you overhead with it. They don't show you the scary thing. Yeah. They create that ambiance. That seems like it's hard to pull off, though.
It really is. So it's so hard to pull off a film where it might be there and it might not be there, and you may never see it. And that is why I do believe, and I've been to a number of scary movies where people are laughing, because it just doesn't ring true. It's not believable. You just don't buy into the story. So that skill of being able to scare somebody or have that anticipation, it's all about timing. And they talk about in comic land how you have to have that comedic timing. Well, that's the same kind of thing here when you're talking about scary land. You really have to have good timing.
Hey, Reggie, let's revisit Silence of the Lambs. And we've got a clip here of the famous Hannibal Lecter who's berating the FBI agent Clarice Starling.
You know what you look like to me with your good bag and your cheap shoes? You look like a rube. A well-scrubbed, hustling rube with a little taste. Good nutrition's given you some length of bone, but you're not more than one generation from poor wire trash, are you, Agent Starling? And that accent you've tried so desperately to shed, pure West Virginia.
That, to me, reminds me of this slow and steady chill, and things are just going south, you know? Reggie, what do you think?
Well, the science... Silence of the Lambs, for me, that's a scary movie, just because this guy is crazy. I think deranged. So just the way in which he played that character would make you scared of anything. Come on. Tell me I'm not.
Definitely, yeah. I mean,
cannibalism, you know. Yeah, that'll get you.
But I mean, Anthony Hopkins, if he acted that way and it was a toothpaste commercial, I'd still come away scared.
Yeah. Again, it's the believability piece here. This one, you didn't have the dark, you didn't have creepy crawly things, you didn't have a scary place, you had a scary person. Just a plain scary person, and it worked.
Definitely. Talking to Reggie Ponder about scary movies, back to your calls with Nikki in East Troy. Nikki, hi.
Hi, I was actually calling in because one of the movies that scared me was Darkness Falls. I don't know if you guys remember about the Tooth Fairy, but the fact that that's something that you're brought up as a little kid to believe in, that she's a good person, that she's going to leave a dollar under your pillow for your tooth, that's somebody who's going to come take your tooth, and if you see her, she's going to kill you. So that kind of made me afraid of the dark when I was younger, and I actually have not seen that movie since.
How old were you when you saw this, Nikki?
I want to say I was 11 or 12.
Okay, all right. A little old for Tooth Fairy money there, I guess. But still, yeah, taking that familiar thing and putting a creepy twist on it, Reggie, like in this case, the Tooth Fairy.
That's right. I did not see Darkness Falls, but when you put that, everybody loves the Tooth Fairy. You'll take your own tooth out so you can get some money. So now that they're going to play on that whole thing, it will hurt a kid. Why would you do that? We need to talk to the producers and the director of that one, because that's just unfair to 12 and 13-year-old children.
So, Reggie, here's the burning question. I want to know if there are any scary movies that you are going to be watching as you get closer to Halloween here.
Well, there's three that are out, and one is Ouija, Origin of Evil. I will not be watching it because I'm not going to run out and see that. That whole Ouija board stuff, that's a little bit too real for me. No, thank you. Then there's the other one is going to be Boo, a Madea Halloween. That's going to be hilarious. I know they're going to laugh, and it's a comedy, so there might be some scary things there, but I don't think it's going to be anything to scare you. I think the one that's going to scare me a bit is the movie 31, which is directed by Rob Zombie. So that's coming out, and it looks scary from looking at the trailers, so I think I'm going to go check that one out.
Reggie, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for being with us again.
No problem. I appreciate it. You guys have a scary and ghoulish time.
That's Reggie Ponder, known as Reggie the Real Critic. He appears weekly on Vocalo in Chicago and elsewhere. He joins us to talk about scary movies leading up to Halloween. Stick around. More to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.